Welcome to Idle Chatter, brought to you by the Machinery Digest, where steel and soil meet. A weekly podcast by a New Jersey farmer to all farmers and ranchers across this great nation. And yes, there are farms in New Jersey. Regardless of the crop you grow or the livestock you raise, we all have one thing in common. Agriculture runs on passion, sweat, tears, and machinery, and that is why the Machinery Digest exists, a no-nonsense, grease-under-your-fingernails educational website. It was created to provide a transfer of knowledge so that you can maintain, service, and most importantly, understand today's complex farm equipment. My name is Ray Bohax, and I farm too. It is time now to get under the sheet metal. Hello, my friends, and welcome to Idle Chatter. This is the show from the Farm Machinery Digest, and I am your host, Ray Bohax, the Hot Rod Farmer, coming to you from Cat Swamp Road in Hackettstown, New Jersey, Warren County, to places all around the world, which is kind of, you know, really humbling for me to believe. And I always say this, that the people around the world are listening to Idle Chatter, this podcast, and also visiting my website, Farm Machinery Digest. So I really want to thank you for that, and always please know that I do not take any one of you for granted. Any one of you listeners or visitors to the website, is that I honor all of you, and it's a blessing for you to be able to listen to this poor dry land farmer from New Jersey. It's not a blessing to you, it's a blessing to me. I said that wrong, right? That's not that good. I'm trying to be humble, and I end up messing that up. Well, that's not a good way to start the show, but anyway, I think that you know what I meant. So welcome once again. And today is Monday, February 25th, and it is the Monday before Commodity Classic. So I will be going to Commodity Classic. I'll be leaving on Wednesday and flying out of Newark Airport to Orlando, Florida, and will be at Commodity Classic at the Firestone Ag booth. And I will be there Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, the 3 days of the show. I will probably leave the booth a little bit early on Saturday because I think I have a flight out about 2:30 in the afternoon. But the other days, I'll definitely be there all day. So if you have the opportunity, please stop by the Firestone Ag booth and just say hello. I would love to meet you. And also, Brad Harris, the lead engineer from Firestone Ag, is going to be giving, over the course of Commodity Classic, I think possibly five little seminars. He does an excellent job. They're usually like 10 or 15 minutes, 20-minute seminars about tires. You do not have to have Firestone tires, though I think it would be a mistake not to, to come to the seminar, obviously. But the thing is that the information that he's giving you is generic tire information. You could apply that to any brand of tire. And, you know, the folks at Firestone, which I'm so, you know, grateful to be partnered with, you know, share the same edict that I do. They're cut from the same cloth, and they want to educate the farmer. And all I ask is that when it comes time to buy tires, either spec them out on a new piece of equipment or on an older piece of equipment that you're retiring. I always use that term, retiring, because in the auto industry we use the term repowering when you're putting a new engine, a different engine in the car. So retiring, that you look at the Firestone brand. And I could echo that, because Harvey Firestone was a farmer, and you're buying a tire from a farmer. And all of their research is done at the Firestone Test Farm in Columbiana, Ohio. Real neat place. The past 2 years, I've filmed all my segments for the Successful Farming TV show there. So that's, I'm very intimate with the facility. It's a great facility, about 400 acres, and really neat. So listen, come by Commodity Classic. If you're at Commodity Classic, please come by and say hello. I would love to shake your hand. Learn about your farm or your ranch operation, and if you have some pictures, look at them, and I just really want to be able to connect with you. So listen, we're going to have a show today, and it's a slippery subject, and it is about engine oil. And so it's one of the topics I've wanted to discuss for quite some time. And probably later on, or maybe a month or so from now, or 6 weeks from now, whatever, there's no real time frame, is that I will do a follow-up to this show on hydraulic fluid. There's too much content to put into one show like this, and specifically, being an audio, being a radio type show, is that there's no visual aids. So I have to be able to talk more and to try to explain something than, the old adage, a picture is worth a thousand words. But anyway, what I would like to just share with you is I had a very blessed week. And it was blessed in the sense that I heard from two people from the show. Now, that is not, I don't want you to think that that's a rare occurrence, but I got a very nice letter from Mr. Riley Lewis, and he owns Lewis Century Stock Farms in LaGrange, Indiana, which I know where, not where their farm is, but I know where LaGrange is. And what Riley wrote to me, and I'm not going to read you the entire letter, but he wrote, "I am a dairy and crop farmer in LaGrange, Indiana, and I love the Idle Chatter podcast. I just started the podcast a few weeks ago, and I am rolling through the episodes. But as another listener mentioned, I didn't know how little I knew. And this is both exciting and yet overwhelming, as I try very hard not to suffer from NIH, not invented here." So he listened to that show in the archives. "So love finding out new ways to do things better, especially when it involves preventing future disasters. So basically, I feel like we are doing everything wrong on the farm and the shop. We only look at price and cut tons of corners and fear that we will have a multitude of problems forming." And I'm going to stop his letter there. And the reason why I read this to you is that I wanted to give a shout out to Riley, but also I wanted to say that in so many ways, and this is a lonely occupation or a lonely profession. Over the years, I've written for so many magazines. I think I've written for 45 different magazine titles, car magazines, boating magazines, RV magazines, agricultural magazines, and you're doing the website and doing the TV show for Successful Farming, and now doing my show on the internet radio here, the podcast. And what I mean by a lonely profession is I'm not looking for any sympathy. But for instance, when I used to write for Hot Rod magazine years back, they would have approximately about they had probably 1.5 million readers. Let me clarify that. They had probably about a little bit more than 1 million. They bounced around 1 million subscribers. And then with the industry, they have what they call pass-along readership. And the pass-along readership is that you leave the magazine in a coffee shop or a barbershop, and someone else reads it. And, you could put for 3 years, I was in every issue of Hot Rod magazine as a contributor. And so basically, figure in 3 years, you had 36 million people, arguably, read what you wrote. And I know that they did, because they used to do an audit, and I think 97% of the people used to read my articles. So anyway, you have, 30 million, 10 million, 5 million people, and you hear no feedback from anyone. And good, bad, or indifferent, and usually whatever feedback you do get is basically somebody just chastising you. But anyway, with very little to no feedback whatsoever. And then it makes you feel that, what am I doing? Is it resonating with people? Do I think it works? And, do I think I should be writing this? Should I change it? And what have you. And why I wanted to share Riley's letter with you is that it's my heartfelt desire to help the agricultural community, and to know that there are many of you out there. Riley is not the only one, but he wrote a letter to me about it, and saying that he recognizes that the farm shop on his operation has the potential to make or break it financially. And I applaud him for that, and I applaud all the others that are listening to this show, because in your own way you're recognizing that. And I feel that I have an obligation to you, my listeners, and the people who visit the website, to be able to help you to look at your equipment and to realize that the best yields in the world, the best market prices in the world, can very easily be evaporated or erased by poor decisions in the farm shop. So the idea that Riley is working hard to implement a lot of the things that I represent on the show is not tooting my own horn. What it basically is, it's a confirmation and an affirmation that I'm on the right course and I truly want to help the American farmer and rancher. That may not have come out right, but I hope that, God willing, you understand what I'm saying. Is that I don't need a million people writing to me, and I don't want anybody just. I don't want that. I want to know that I'm helping you. And the best letters basically are saying I implemented something and this worked, and I saved some money, or the equipment, my equipment, is more reliable or runs better, what have you. That, to me, that's hitting the lottery. So it makes me so happy. So thank you, Riley, for writing your letter to me. And I'm going to open a dialogue with him right when I get back from Commodity Classic. And I'm going to give him some helpful hints on what he could do as far as he's concerned with fluid testing, what have you. And I know from his letter that all I got to do is steer him in the right direction, and he'll take that baby home and make it work for him. And the other person that I want to shout out to is Noah Fraser from Lockington, Victoria, Australia. And as I said last week, he is my youngest reader. So Noah, please send me a picture. Send me a picture of yourself. Your daddy works at a New Holland dealer. I know it's the rural group. I killed the name of the town the first time last week, so I'm not doing that again. That I massacred that. But, hey, Noah, send me a picture. Hot Rod Farmer at FarmMachineryDigest.com. Send me a picture standing next to a piece of farm equipment, either yours or at the dealership, a nice piece of New Holland, nice New Holland tractor combine, and hopefully it has Firestone tires on it. So send that over, Noah, and I'll post that on my website. He's my youngest listener that I'm aware of, 11-year-old Noah Fraser from Lockington, Victoria, Australia, and I know that he's just a great kid from what I heard, and I hope that what he listens to here, he'll be able to take and make a wonderful career for himself in agriculture, because I know that his dad told me through correspondence that he loves machinery. But anyway, what we're going to talk about today is engine oil. And ironically, when Dave Fraser, Noah's dad, had contacted me, I already had planned to do this week's show about engine oil. And he said to me, "Gee, you know, if you could ever do a show on engine oil, I would really appreciate that." And I said, "You must be a mind reader, because that's what I had planned for this week." So that is what we're going to cover. And then I have a letter here, if I didn't lose it. Okay, from a question for our special delivery segment at the end of the show, and it is from an author in Western Tennessee, and we'll get to that. He's asking about water pumps. So, okay, so what we're basically going to do is I'm going to try to succinctly give you a lesson on oils. Now, there's a term, not a term, there's a name called a tribologist. And you would tend to think that it's somebody who works with blood or something. But a tribologist is someone who studies lubricants. So you could actually go and get a degree in tribology, and it's a person who makes the study of lubricants and oils, but basically they're lubricants. They don't necessarily have to be oils, but they are. So in full disclosure, I am not a degreed tribologist. So I'm going to give you the engine, the Hot Rod Farmer version of tribology, which is basically all you need to know about engine oils, and anything beyond that, we're not going to get mired in chemistry and composition and molecular chains and what have you. You know, whenever I write anything, let's say like in Successful Farming or car magazines or something about oils, I want to give the reader something that they could really, you know, take to the bank with them, that makes sense. And then, you know, ultimately, and I say this respectfully, you know, ultimately you'll get somebody who's going to write in, and the guy's a tribologist, and he's going to tell you about TBN, total base number, and he's going to give you a molecular chain and everything, and you know, hey, that person is well educated and well versed on that, and I'm not. But, you know, the molecular chain from this oil versus that oil is not going to give, you know, put any money in your pocket as a farmer. You need to understand how to be an educated consumer to buy the proper oils for your engines, and you need to have a basic understanding of oils and how they interact with the engine, and that's basically it. You don't need anything more. You're not going to be over there brewing up home brew of oil, and that's what the oil companies are for, and that's why they have people with PhD in it and engineering degrees in laboratories to test all of this stuff. We need to be able to be a consumer of the product and buy the right product, as you would buy the right fertilizer for your farm, or you would buy the right seed. This time of year, everybody's going through the seed catalogs and deciding what hybrids, what varieties they're going to plant in what fields, where they're going to plant it. You're going to go with triple stack, you're going to go with what have you, you're going to go with non-GMO, you can go to traded corn or a traded soybean. So that's what we need to know about oil. We need to know the traits of it. We need to know, you know, is it a triple stack, you know, or is it a BT corn? Is it a GMO corn? And then we can make the right decision. So that's what we're going to cover today. So it's going to be a two-part, not two parts in two different weeks. It's going to be two parts in today's show. And the first part is I'm going to talk about viscosity of oils, because that's always confusing. And the second part is going to be, I'm going to discuss about synthetic versus mineral oils. Because, you know, you get a bunch of farmers together in a coffee shop in the morning, and if the topic of engine oil comes up, forget about it. You'll be there all day long, and it'd be worse than talking politics or religion, because everybody's going to have their own opinion, and they're going to argue back and forth about it as if it was the end of the world. So we're going to discuss that in the second part. But the first part is going to be a basic overview of oils and viscosity. You know, oil brands, there's probably two or three types of people, farmers, when it comes to engine oil. You have the brand loyal guys, you have the cost guys, whatever they could buy cheaply, right? And then you have another group that bounces back and forth and feels that there should be a synthetic oil in the motor or an engine or mineral oil, what have you. So there's a couple of different groups of people. But, you know, just like with farm equipment, you get people that are just very loyal to that color equipment. And you and I all know what we mean in agriculture when we say color, right? That the brand of equipment. And then you do have that to a certain extent with oil. But what will, you know, what's confusing is that you could go to the store and you could look for, let's say, a 10W30 oil. And you could find all different brands, all different prices, all different compositions. It could be a pure mineral oil. It could be a pure synthetic oil. Or full synthetic is the word they would use, not pure. Full synthetic. And it could be a blend. And then within those categories, you'll see oils with all different pricing structures. And everyone claims to be the best, but the common denominator they use is that they say it meets a certain SAE, which is Society of Automotive Engineers, and API, American Petroleum Institute, test standard. And those usually are going to be letters like SJ, CD, or sometimes they'll have a number with it, rarely, but usually it's a combination of letters. And what those letters will define is a test standard that was either created by the Society of Automotive Engineers or the American Petroleum Institute for that oil. And unless you know what the protocol, what the test standards are, that really means nothing to you. What is important is that you have to look in the owner's manual of that engine, whether it's a car, a motorcycle, a irrigation pump, or engine on a seed tender, or a tractor combine, it's irrelevant, is that you will need to look at the owner's manual. But over the past 20 or 25 years, it was probably 30 years now, was also stamped or written on the oil fill cap, and it says use oil that meets blah, blah, blah standard or above. Now, what's going to happen is with the SAE and API standards, specifically the oil composition is usually an API standard, and the viscosity, the numeric rating of the oil, is usually the SAE standard. But you could find that to move around a little bit and have some overlap. But what you need to understand is that as far as the letter codes are concerned, SFJ, SFG, the higher up in the alphabet, so C versus B is a newer composition oil. So the standard started with letter A, and then they're working themselves up the alphabet. And if that comes back again, then they'll add two letters. So it'll be AD or AD or AG is in girl. So AG would be a different standard and a later standard than AC or AD. So the further up in the alphabet is the later standard. And for most part, unless you're running very, very old equipment, is that the standards are reverse compatible. So an oil standard that would work for a 2019 John Deere combine, if that standard, let's say it's superseded older standard on your 2005 combine, is that oil, the newer oil, will actually be backward compatible to the older application. So, and if you get very, very old, let's say 40 or 50 years old, then it wouldn't be 100% backward compatible, but for the most part, you're not going to hurt anything. But most people are not farming with 40 or 50 year old pieces of equipment, and some people are, and you could use an oil with a modern standard with no real concern. It's a little bit different than it would be with diesel fuel, because diesel fuel, even though you have no choice, you have to buy ultra-low sulfur diesel fuel, is that the process, that, as I said before in the show, the process to remove the sulfur, remove the lubricity. So that gave it, so you have to have a little bit of concern with an older engine, and even with a newer engine, you need to use a lubricity additive. But as far as oil is concerned, they're backward compatible for probably any type of equipment that you would be able to use on your farm. So now the oil will have a standard that it met, and it will also have a rating. Let's say 10W30, 5W20, 10W50, 15W40, whatever it may be. And this numeric rating is often very confusing because it is the viscosity of the oil. Now, most people think that viscosity is the thickness of the oil. That's very viscous. That's thick, the thickness of the oil. But the true definition of viscosity is a fluid's resistance to flow. So the viscosity defines the force required to move a given layer of fluid past another layer at a given speed and standard separation. So that is the technical definition of viscosity. So you're trying to have, and they actually have a laboratory test procedure. That number is not defined, you know, just throwing dots at a wall, at a board, a cork board, and figure what the viscosity is. And they'll have, let's say, like a piece of glass, almost like a slide that they do for blood testing, and they'll put the oil on there, and they'll take another piece of oil. This was the old procedure. They may have a more modern computerized one. And what they'll do is they'll have the oil on that also, and they want to try to slide it across one another. And then this is all laboratory testing. And the thing is that, so the viscosity defines how much force is needed for that given layer of fluid to pass another layer at a given speed and separation. So the higher the viscosity of the oil does not necessarily mean that it is thicker. In layperson's terms, when we pour it out of the can, it may look thicker, or the bottle, or the jug, or what have you. Well, we want to convince ourselves that it looks a little bit thicker, but it's really not a thickness measurement. So it's not like you're saying, well, it's that oil's thick like honey, my father used to say. He used to think that was good, but that was the old school mentality. And it's thick like honey. And then, so that is not the true indication of viscosity. It's a laboratory test of the fluid's ability to flow over one another. And that's important because if you realize the oil has to flow through all passages in the engine, and its ability or its resistance to flow, how much force it needs to push through those parts, the bearing clearances, through the rocker arms, through the main bearings, the rod bearings, the the pistons. It may have an oil squirter on the bottom of the piston, the valve train, what have you. The oil galleries through the block. So the higher the viscosity of that oil, the harder or the more force it's going to need to be pushed through that engine. All right, so we're going to touch back on that in a couple of minutes. Now, when you look at an oil, years ago they had a single viscosity oil. Straight 30, straight 40, straight 50. They probably had straight 20. I don't remember that. And then when they came out with the multi-viscosity oils, which was probably sometime in the 1950s into the 1960s, they added the letter W. So let's say if we'll pick on 15W40 and use that as a common denominator through this show, this part of the show. So people used to think that, and many people think that the W means weight, 15W-40. What the W stands for is winter. It does not stand for weight. And the benefit of a multi-viscosity oil is that it's a chameleon. It acts like two different blends of oil. So in the winter, it'll act like a 15-weight oil, which is an oil with a lower viscosity, and it's not a lower thickness. I'll repeat it. It has the needs. It's easier to push through the engine. It's easier, it's less force to push through the engine, and will move quicker with a given force. And then at higher temperatures, it will act like a 40-weight oil, which becomes harder to push through the engine. All right? So the W stands for winter and not weight. So if we have so the benefit of a multi-viscosity oil is that it allows the engine to be lubricated properly at both cold temperatures and hotter temperatures and have an oil that will support the loads there, versus a single viscosity oil would be akin to like a pesticide that only has reaction on one weed. So if you have a pesticide that's only a grass pesticide, it'll kill anything in the grass family, but it's not going to kill any broadleafs. All right, so the thing is that, so look at this as multiple modes of action in a pesticide. So this is multiple modes of action, two modes of action in the oil as far as its interaction with the parts of the engine dependent upon the weather. Now, so in essence, what will happen is that the oil, the 1540, the oil with the lower viscosity, number 15, and there is an actual quantifier for this. If you will go to API, they give you all the tests and whatever the values. Like I said, they don't just arbitrarily pick a number. It will act like a thin oil when it is cold, and it will respond like a thicker, a higher viscosity oil when it's hot. So they were designed to provide the best of both worlds. But the rating, the 15W40, does not tell the entire story. And getting back, going to the store, right, you can see there's many different 1540 oils that meet the same SAE and API standard, right? So what is the difference? The guy who says, I'm buying the cheapest stuff that's on sale, I don't give a damn because it's all snake oil, it's the same thing, it meets the same standards. Well, he's only right up to a certain extent, and sadly his pocketbook will eventually pay for it because his engines will wear excessively. So what would happen, or what you need to recognize, and I'm going to put this very simply, not to belabor you with it, is that numerous factors make oil a premium or just an acceptable lubricant. All right, like anything in life. You could buy anything. There's all different levels of quality. You could look to buy a tire for your car, a tire for your tractor. There's many different brands. They're all the same size, but there's different levels of quality and performance. And the same thing happens with oils. And the quality, what makes it a better lubricant, even if it meets the same standards, is based upon the crude oil that they use, the refining process, the additives that they employ, and there's a number of other things. But for this show today, we're just going to be concerned with viscosity, and we're going to be concerned with, later on in the show, what a synthetic oil is. Now, this is what I teach. This is the example I like to give. So let's say that you're harvesting corn, and you take 2 points from the field and record the yield from the monitor, all right? So you have your son riding with your daughter, and you say, okay, record the yield on the monitor here, record it here, and they write down on a piece of paper, all right? So let's say when you went into the field, the opening of the field, it produced 200 bushels per acre. And then in the middle of the field, we had real good ground. Everything was good, right? There was a lot of cross-pollination, what have you. You have 305 bushels per acre. So now, you could make at the coffee shop a very true statement. And you could say the ground around the entry in the field yielded 200 bushels per acre. And in the middle of the field, it yielded 305 bushels per acre. All right? I don't think anybody's going to argue with me with those numbers. But so that's the field's performance, its yield, its performance, right, for those 2 points. But that tells you nothing about the yield in the other areas of the field. And, you know, to break away for a second, no disrespect, I would say it, is that I think if I were the National Corn Growers Association, the soybean growers, what have you, is that I think it's wonderful that these high-yield guys get these numbers in their fields. You know, 500 bushels per acre, 200 bushels beans, whatever it may be, right? But the thing is that I would also like to see what their on-farm average is. And I realize that's usually a five-acre test plot, but the thing basically is you're getting back to my show a couple of weeks ago about volumetric efficiency, is that if you're only looking at 2 points, you're looking at that, then, you know, that data is accurate for those 2 points, but it's not accurate for the whole farm. And the same thing is with the oil. So what you need to understand is how that rating comes about. So this is like Paul Harvey used to say, it's the rest of the story. The viscosity rating of the oil is its performance at an assigned temperature for cold and hot. Now, I'm going to give you the standards that I've been working with. They may be slightly outdated. The temperature standards may have changed a couple of degrees either way, but this is, you know, close enough for you to understand whether it's 212 or 218 now, it doesn't make any difference. All right? So the cold temperature test, so the 15W, the winter test, all right, the 15W is at 0 degrees F. And the hot test, so if you have a 15W40 oil, that means it flows like a 15-weight oil at 0 degrees F, and it flows like a 40-weight oil at 212 degrees F. So that is what the multiviscosity oil is. So we only know its performance at those two temperatures. So it's akin to you looking at the yield monitor on the combine. You know at the entry of the field you had 200 bushels per acre, and at this spot in the field you have 305 bushels per acre. But what happened in between? We do not know. All right. So the same thing is with the oil. We know that this brand oil, that if it's a 15W oil, it's going to have that flow characteristic at 0 degrees, whether it's the most expensive oil or the cheapest oil, and it's going to have the other flow characteristic, the 40-weight flow characteristic at 0 degrees, 212 degrees, excuse me. Yeah, so hot and cold. But we don't know anything else. Now, to get back to Paul Harvey, where's the rest of the story? Well, the rest of the story, the full story, is you need something that's called the visometric, V-I-S-O-M-E-T-R-I-C, visometric index chart. And what that will basically do is will plot the oil's performance above the winter rating and below the hot rating, and then beyond those two, so below 0 degrees and above 212 degrees, because most oil runs at 240, 250 today in a crankcase, all right? So you're just saying it's good at 2, this is what the numbers are, 212. So you need a visometric index chart to be able to determine the oil's true performance. The thing is that no one prints that, because that is not required by government standards, nor is it required by SAE or API. So when you buy a better grade of oil that is made, what I mean by a better grade, a better brand, which is usually indicated by price structure, all right, is that it will have more uniform performance, and it will have an expanded temperature range, and it'll be very linear in its performance, and it won't be very digital. And what I mean by that is that you could have an inexpensive 15W40 oil that meets the standards at 0 degrees and 212 degrees. That's why they put 15W40 on it, all right? But it skews greatly in the viscosity above and below that temperature. And that is where your engine will experience excessive wear. So that is why it is important to use a high-quality oil that has the additive package, the refining, the good base oils, the high quality base oils, so its performance will not go off the cliff below 0 degrees or above 212 degrees. As I have said before on the show, is that I kind of got involved with Twitter. I'm not a social media person, no disrespect to it. All right, to get people to know about my website and the show here, and somebody had tweeted out a picture. I don't even know if he was a follower of mine. Maybe they refollowed. I don't know. I'm probably saying it all wrong. But anyway, I saw the picture, and it was during that cold spell, and I think it was a Mack engine. It was a big diesel. I think it may have been a Mack, and I guess he's in the repair business. And the customer started on a real cold day, and when they had the real cold weather out in the Midwest a couple of weeks ago, it's still cold there. And he ended up here, knock, 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 and he wiped out the bearings. And he's saying, oh, man, you know, it's an oil flow, it's this, it's that. And very, very well may have been. But the oil issue may have been because he had, and I don't know this, right, but I'm saying when I was looking at the picture of the bearing that he tweeted out, if that's a proper term, is that he could have had a cheap oil. Let's say it was a 1540 diesel oil. And then it's going to flow like a 15 weight at 0 degrees. But what does it flow like at minus 20? And he could have wiped that motor out simply because he had a oil of poor quality that the visometric index chart, which you cannot see, had very poor flow characteristics. Or conversely, let's say, you know, Noah's 11 years old now. So let's say another 4 or 5 years, I don't know when they could drive in Australia, and he's running a tractor on the farm, or he's running a semi, bringing grain to town. And his father hasn't put cheap oil in, and the oil's running 260, 270, 280. What is the flow characteristic is going to be at that particular temperature? Is it going to be thermally stable? Will it be able to take the pressure loads at that temperature? There's a lot of things. I mean, we could do 4 or 5 hours on oil viscosity. But the take-home message I want you to recap here is that when you are buying a name brand oil that is made of higher quality additives, higher quality base oil, a better refining process, the thing is that oil, if you were to be able to see the visometric index chart, that oil will have exemplary performance above and below those set points and will have linear performance. It's not going to go where it goes off the cliff and skews greatly at 213 degrees instead of 212 degrees. So you may have a cheap oil that at 220 degrees jumps down to 20 weight viscosity instead of 40. And that's where you get yourself into trouble. And, you know, so many farmers don't want to buy, and I'm not saying there's not good oils out there. There are good aftermarket oils, and, you know, you could tell by the pricing, you could tell by the company's background, do some research. I mean, there's excellent, excellent aftermarket oils. There's no denying that, all right? But the thing is that you have to buy a good name brand, not Joe's Oil Company from Hackettstown, New Jersey. But the thing is that Ray's Oil Company, right? But the thing is that with this newer equipment and, you know, if you're running a John Deere tractor and you just bought a $600,000 John Deere combine or a $200,000 tractor, or you went to auction, you bought a pre-owned piece of equipment that's a couple of years old, you know, if you run different colors, I know it's a problem, and you could buy a good oil, a Chevron, a Mobile, Delvac, Shell, Mobile One, whatever. There's plenty of good oils out there. But keep in mind that when you buy the OE oil, and is that you have the additive package that manufacturer wants. So the thing is that, are there good oils? Yes. Excellent oils? Yes. I'm not going to say if you bought a new machine, that if you used, you know, use Chevron in it or Shell, I can't think of names, or Mobile, that there's going to be a problem. By no means whatsoever. The viscometric performance of that oil is going to be superior to a cheap oil. But what's going to happen is that you're going to have a different additive package, possibly, in the branded oil from the OE manufacturer. And that additive package is, you know, may affect the seals that are in that engine. It may affect the gaskets in an engine. I don't know what it's going to affect. So I'm not going to say buyer beware. I don't want you to come away from this, you know, and be turned off and say, I got to use this oil. No. Use a name brand oil. The thing that you're buying really is the viscometric index performance of that oil, which is going to be its thermal stability, its ability to handle pressure, load, its ability to resist creating gunk in the engine and all of that. But today we're basically talking about viscosity. So to recap this, right, the viscosity of an oil is at 2 points in temperature. It's going to be its resistance to flow. All right, it's going to be its resistance to flow one layer over another, how much force is required at 0 degrees, that's the multi-viscosity oil, which everything is today, 0 degrees, which is the W, winter, and then at 212 degrees. And the take-home message here is that better brand of oil will have a much broader performance range above and below those set points where your engine really needs it, because your engine doesn't stay long at zero other than startup, and most of the damage could happen on an engine on startup because the bearings, everything is dry, and then also afterwards as the engine becomes thermally loaded and starts to build heat, that the performance of that oil, the what's called the oil wedge, and I'll do a show later on about oil wedge, is that the performance of the oil for it to be able to keep the metal parts from the bearing and the crank or the bearing and the rod separated is what's called the oil wedge. It's different than the bearing clearance. The bearing clearance may be 2.5 thousandths, but the oil wedge is much smaller than that. And it's that little bit of oil that is keeping those two parts from touching. And then what will happen is that the viscometric index chart and the additives that they put in the oil and the base oil that they use and what have you will create a product that will allow that oil to be thermally stable and to be able to take the pressures and that support that oil wedge, along with a host of other things. Its ability not to make acids, its ability not to build sludge. There's something called pumpability of the oil, cold pumpability, something called wettability of the oil. That's how quickly it drains from the parts when you shut the engine off, or an oil spray and it leaks down. That's called wettability. And keep in mind that engine oil is also meant to be a coolant. It cools the crankshaft. It removes heat from the bottom of the pistons, especially if it's got oil sprayers. It lubricates things. Anything that there's a lubricant, that there's movement, there's friction. Friction is heat. And oil is used to pull that heat away. And that's why engines today use basically a low pressure, high volume oiling system, because what they want to basically do is keep flooding that bearing, flooding those parts with fresh oil to move the heat away. And prior to the modern oil chemistry, you needed a very high viscosity oil, all right, that it was very hard for it to pump through a crevice, pump through there. And that was the only way that the the tribologists knew how to have it sustain the pressure demands to maintain the oil wedge. You look at an NHRA Pro Stock motor now, 499.8 cubic inches, 1,500 horsepower, 9,600 RPM, all right, two carburetors and push rods. The oil that they pour in there looks like water. All right, but the thing basically is the chemistry today, the chemistry that they've learned how to make oil better. And the thing is that before we used to have to put this high viscosity oil in to be able to keep those parts separated with that oil wedge. You don't need to do that anymore. So that's why so many of these new engines have low viscosity oils, because remember the viscosity is its opposition to want to pump, to move, right, over another area. And the thing is that when it's cold, it could get the oil up to the parts quicker, especially with overhead cam engines. Some big diesels, a lot of big diesels are overhead cam. So you have the oil in the sump. When you start that thing, you want to get that oil up to the top of that valve train as soon as possible. And then a modern oil, modern chemistry with the lower viscosities will do that. Now, what we're going to touch on quickly here, because it's very simple, is synthetic oil. Is synthetic oil better than mineral oil? Yes. Is mineral oil better than synthetic was 30 years ago, mineral oil today? Yes. We keep raising the bar, just like farmers keep raising the yield in their fields. The yield that we have in 2018, the average yield is much more than we had in 1990 and in 1950 and in 1900. So the oil is getting better. So did the mineral oil get better? Yes. Did the synthetic oil get better? Yes. But what basically happens is that what is a synthetic oil? And a synthetic oil simply starts off as a regular mineral oil. And what happens is that the term synthetic is misleading, since all engine lubricants have their roots in mineral oil, or crude oil pumped from the ground. What happens to that oil, which is defined as the base stock, right? The base stock is the oil that's used to make engine oil, whether it's synthetic or mineral, that allows it to become a synthetic. The confusion was similar to what agriculture is going through with defining vertical tillage. Each manufacturer has its own definition of vertical tillage. And this guy says, we're not true vertical, we're vertical. They go like that, and they go back and forth. So due to this confusion of what truly was a synthetic oil, the SAE developed a standard, which is J357, like the gun 357 Magnum, J357. And that describes the synthetic base stocks before the additives are introduced as chemicals produced directly derived from petroleum base stocks. So what this means is that synthetic lubricants are highly refined, and they use a process that so dramatically changes the molecular structure that they cannot be categorized as mineral anymore. So basically, in essence, they're taking a specific type and grade of mineral oil, they're putting it through a synthesizing process, so we'll say a conversion process, and now the molecular structure has changed so much that you cannot identify it as a mineral oil anymore because it's so highly refined. So in essence, to make a simple analogy, you could have an old rotary dial telephone and you could have the latest smartphone, whatever number it is, 10, 12, who the heck knows, I don't follow that stuff. But anyway, so they're both telephones, right? You pick them up, you can go talk to somebody. But one is a smartphone and one is a rotary dial phone. So in essence, that's what happens with a synthetic. It's a base crude mineral oil, a base stock. They call base stock oil a certain high-quality base stock. And then I'll use the word refined. It's actually a synthesizing process. It's so highly refined that it remakes or modifies the molecular structure, the molecular chain, not to get too technical, is altered, and that's why they called a synthetic. But synthetic oils start with base oils, and that process is what's and the molecular structure of a synthetic oil, the molecules are smaller. So that is why years ago people said, you put synthetic oil in the motor, it starts to leak. And they were correct empirically because the molecular structure was smaller and that would allow it to find leaks that a larger molecule would not find. You know, just like if you look at soil, certain nutrients in the soil are immovable or they don't really move much. Other things leach very easily, so it's the size of the molecular structure. So just like the calcium molecule is larger in soil, is larger than the magnesium molecule. So if you have your calcium-magnesium ratio or magnesium-calcium ratio, however you want to state it, off in your base saturation, you have too much mag, you get very fine little molecules all packed together, and then you have a soil that compacts easily, that doesn't drain well and what have you. Now you get the calcium in it, when you put larger molecules in it, and it makes pathways for the water to go down and for the soil structure to be different. So same thing happens with the synthetic oil. So what does this mean to you? What this means is that when you use a synthetic oil, what you're getting is an oil that's more thermally stable. You're getting an oil that has more of a detergent-like effect for it. And most importantly, you have an oil that's going to have a better viscometric index, its performance at different temperatures above and below the test ratings of 15 W40, we'll use that, 15 meaning 0 degrees, 40 meaning 212 degrees. You're going to have an oil that's going to flow much better at minus 20. You're going to have an oil that's more thermally stable and able to withstand the oil wedge on the bearings, the crank bearing and the rod bearing, at high temperatures, right, 260, 207 degrees. Hey, you're cutting corn, you're pulling a chisel plow, you're pulling whatever, hot whether you're working that motor, you got that high thermal load in there. And so basically, in essence, a synthetic oil is not voodoo. What it basically done is that it's taken the oil and made it better. And I am a firm believer in synthetic oils. It's not that I have anything against mineral oils, but I run synthetic in everything. I'm a Mobil 1 guy. No disrespect to anybody else. I buy it because it's so easily and readily available. I can go in town, I can go to Walmart, I go to an auto parts store, I can go to a supermarket and get it if I need it. If I'm traveling and I need this oil, I could buy it. So I run synthetic Mobil 1 in my lawnmower. I load it in my lawn tractor. I run it in my farm equipment. I had a 4-stroke weed whacker. I ran it in that. I run it in my power washer. I love it. And, you know, and if you also take a quart of synthetic oil, a good brand of synthetic oil, put it in the refrigerator, and put a quart of mineral oil in the refrigerator and get it down to 2 or 3 or 4 degrees below 0, 5 degrees. Most freezers, I say put in a freezer, not refrigerator. Just don't tell your wife you're doing it. But anyway, and you'll see that even though it'll be a 1540 oil, that the synthetic oil will have greater flowability at that 10 degrees below 0 and flow easier as at that temperature than the other oil, because that rating has to have a minimum flow at that. If it flows better, it doesn't get quantified in that 15W40. It's that viscometric index chart that would show that. So to recap all of this, viscosity is not the thickness of the oil, but it's the amount of energy and the way it flows over a surface when there's oil on both parts, which would be like a bearing. Is that you want to buy the best oil you can. You want to use a multi-viscosity oil. And if you don't mind spending the extra money, then synthetic oils are definitely the way to go. If you have an older piece of equipment and you bought it, has a lot of hours on it, I probably would not waste the extra money to put a synthetic oil in it right now. So at this particular point, I would use probably a good brand mineral oil and that has a good viscometric index performance based upon the brand, and I would call it quits, because at that particular point, if it's got 5,000 hours and you bought it and it always had mineral oil in it, I mean, whatever. The wear is there, whatever. I don't think it's going to add any life. But, you know, years ago, I used to have a Wonder Bread commercial. They say it's the Wonder Bread years, a young person. Well, when you get that newer piece of equipment, that newer car, whatever, I would definitely run a synthetic of the of the classification that that manufacturer wants. Already, if you have any questions about this, please feel free to contact me at hotrodfarmer@farmmachinerydigest.com. And I went through it fast, and I apologize for that, but we're running out of time here on the show, and I want to get this gentleman's question. So, you know, keep in mind that special delivery is brought to you by Firestone Ag. And you, as I said in the beginning, you know, Harvey Firestone was a farmer, so they have that 23-degree tread bar, and that's, you know, that's the industry standard. That's the high water mark as far as a conventional type of tire is concerned, and that is was designed and developed by Firestone. So when it comes time to look at tires, or if you're with Commodity Classic, please, please give Firestone a look. And like I always try to say, is that if you're honest with yourself, the tire may be a couple of dollars more, but they last so many years, your soil will be happier. And remember, the soil is the lifeblood of your farm. So trust it only to Firestone. So the question they have, and I'll read it to you, it says, "Hi, my name is Arthur, and I farm in Western Tennessee. I enjoy your radio show, and I have a question. What can I do to increase water pump life on our engines? Most are hard to change, and they end up leaking through the vent. Also, what is the vent purpose of the vent?" Well, thank you, first of all, Arthur, for listening and for writing in. And I gladly appreciate you tuning in from Western Tennessee, and that's a beautiful part of the country. But anyway, you're probably out near the Missouri border someplace. But a good friend of mine, Danny Stevens, lives down in outside of Hayti, Missouri. He farms down in Hayti with his son, a good guy. So I'm kind of quasi-familiar with your neck of the woods. But anyway, to answer your question, two things that you could do to increase water pump life. All right, the one thing basically is to keep the coolant fresh in your engine, and whether it's a gasoline or a diesel, if it's a larger engine, diesel, and you're going to use test strips, make sure it has all the proper additives, because as the coolant starts to become alkaline, it becomes an acid, and the additive package goes away, it's going to start to deteriorate the seal. So keeping fresh coolant in, or fresh coolant and or properly additized coolant, is one of the biggest things that you could do to increase the water pump life. And historically, most water pumps, the only thing that's going to fail with them is usually the seal and then the bearing afterwards. So if you could keep that seal from leaking, then, and you keep the corrosion at bay, then that water pump will usually last the life of the engine or beyond. So that is the first thing you can do. The second thing that you could do is do not raise the engine RPM too high when the engine is cold and the thermostat is closed. Now, I did a show a while back about not idling an engine to warm up, so I don't want you to think I'm saying that. But you don't want to have an engine when it's cold and have the RPM go up to 3,000, 4,000 RPM on, let's say, like a smaller gasoline engine on a car or a pickup truck, or on a larger diesel engine, go up to 2,000 RPM, what have you. You want to start that engine and put it under load and drive it away, or put whatever the load is. You're using it to aug or something, and it's standing still, but you want the load to be put on it and the RPM not to be too high. And the simple reason for that being is that when the thermostat is closed, the coolant circulates through the bypass system. It could be a bypass hose, a bypass port. And if you raise the RPM too high, you cannot, it's like trying to, it can't move the coolant. It's trying like the, if you were to suck a can of soda and you're closing up the straw, it's going like that, and it actually cavitates the pump, which destroys the pump, but it creates a very, very high level, or I should say, it creates a great depression, a great differential in pressure. So let's say a vacuum. So whereas the atmospheric pressure is high, and inside the water pump at the seal, the pressure is extremely low. So that differential in pressure has the atmosphere pushed through the seal, and it actually starts to violate the seal. And as it starts to violate the seal, I mean, not if it happens one time, if you do this continuously, the seal wears and it starts to leak, and it either drips out of the vent hole. Another part of your question is, what is the vent hole for? The vent hole serves two purposes. Number one is to, if the water pump starts to leak, for it to go someplace and hopefully extend the life of the bearing and and go and be able to come out. And the other purpose of the vent hole is when they push that bearing in there, when they press that bearing in there, so the air has some place to escape. But the thing is that the biggest cause of water pump failure is high RPM. And you have to look at this, you know, for the engine. I mean, 2,000 RPM on a gasoline engine, a pickup truck is not high. 2,000 RPM on a big diesel at red lines at 2,500 is high. So high RPM when the engine is cold and the thermostat is closed and it's only circulating the coolant through the bypass. By the bypass circuit. And if you keep the RPM down, like I say, but I don't want you to sit and idle it, but keep it down, even in that show, I said drive it away easily, is that you will have that cool build temperature, that thermostat will open, and then you will not expose that water pump seal to that high level of pressure differential, which ends up violating that seal and wearing it. Once that seal becomes violated and wear, it starts to leak. So hopefully that answered your question, and I want to thank you so much for writing it. And if it didn't, or you want me to explain it more, you know, once again, please feel free to contact me. So listen, but when you guys, if you listen to the show this week, I'll be at Commodity Classic, so I'll stick my hand up and wave. And if you happen to be there, once again, please stop by at the Firestone Ag booth, and I want to thank you so much for listening, and I greatly appreciate it. I'm honored, and for those that do write in and contact me, I greatly appreciate that, because you remember the old commercials, the Maytag Man, that when you are in this field, you're like the Maytag Man, and all I do want to know is that I don't want any accolades, I don't want anything. I want to be able to feel that I'm using the abilities and knowledge that the good Lord has given me to help you, the American farmer and rancher, and my beloved America. Because remember, no matter what anybody says, is that America cannot be strong without healthy and profitable farms. So thanks again for listening. You have a blessed week, and I'll tell you next time about Commodity Classic. Bye.